The place that Richard got off was not an underground station. It was above ground, and it reminded Richard a little of St. Pancras Station. There was something similarly oversized and mock Gothic about the architecture. But there was also a wrongness that somehow marked it as part of London below. The light was that strange, strained grey one only sees shortly before dawn, and for a few moments after sunset, the times when the world washes out into gloom and colour and distance become impossible to judge. There was a man sitting on a wooden bench watching him, and Richard approached him, cautiously, unable to tell in the murk who the man was, whether it was someone he had met before. Richard was still holding Hunter's knife, his knife, and now he gripped the hilt more tightly, for reassurance. The man looked up as Richard approached and sprang to his feet. He tugged at his forelock, something Richard had previously only seen done on television adaptations of classic novels. He looked both comical and unpleasant. Richard recognized the man as the Lord Ratspeaker.
"Well, well, yes, yes,"
said the rat speaker, agitatedly, beginning in mid-sentence.
"Just to say, the girl anaesthesia, no hard feelings, the rats are your friends still, and the rat speakers, you come to us, we'll do you all right."
"Thanks," said Richard. "Anaesthesia will take him," he thought. "She's expendable." The Lord Ratspeaker fumbled on the bench and presented Richard with a black vinyl zip-up sports bag. It was extremely familiar.
"It's all there, everything. Take a look."
Richard opened the bag. All his possessions were in there, including, on the top of some neatly folded jeans, his wallet. He zipped the bag up and threw it over his shoulder and walked away from the man without a thank you or a backward glance. Richard walked out of the station and down some grey stone steps. All was silent. All was empty. Dead autumn leaves blew across the forecourt, a flurry of yellow and ochre and brown, a sudden burst of muted colour in the dim light. Richard crossed the forecourt and walked down some steps into an underpass. There was a fluttering in the half-dark, and warily he turned. There were about a dozen of them in the corridor behind him, and they slipped towards him almost silently, just a rustle of dark velvet, and, here and there, the clink of silver jewellery. The rustle of the leaves had been so much louder than these pale women. They watched him with hungry eyes. He was scared, then. He had the knife, true, but he could no more fight with it than he could jump across the Thames. He hoped that, if they attacked, he might be able to scare them away with it. He could smell honeysuckle and lily of the valley and musk. Lamia edged her way to the front of the velvets and stepped forward. Richard raised the knife nervously, remembering the chilly passion of her embrace, how pleasant it was and how cold. She smiled at him and inclined her head sweetly. And she kissed her fingertips and blew the kiss towards Richard. He shivered. Something fluttered in the darkness of the underpass, and when he looked again, there was nothing but shadows. Through the underpass, and Richard walked up some steps and found himself at the top of a small grassy hill. It was dawn, and he could just make out details of the countryside around him, almost leafless oak and ash and beech trees, readily identifiable by the shapes of their trunks. A wide, clean river meandered gently through the green countryside. As he looked around, he realized that he was on an island of some kind. Two smaller rivers ran into the larger one, cutting him, on his little hill, off from the mainland. He knew then, without knowing how, but with total certainty, that he was still in London. But London as it had been perhaps 3,000 years ago, or more, before ever the first stone of the first human habitation was laid upon a stone. He unzipped his bag and put the knife away in it, beside his wallet. Then he zipped it up again. The sky was starting to lighten, but the light was odd. It was younger, somehow, than the sunlight he was familiar with. Purer, perhaps. An orange-red sun rose in the east, where Docklands would one day be. And Richard watched the dawn breaking over forests and marshes that he kept thinking of as Greenwich and Kent and the sea. "Hello," said Dor. He had not seen her approach. She was wearing different clothes beneath her battered brown leather jacket. They were still layered and ripped and patched, though, in taffeta and lace and silk and brocade. Her short red hair shone in the dawn, like burnished copper. "Hello," said Richard. She stood beside him and twined her small fingers into his right hand, the hand that was holding the sports bag. "Where are we?" he asked. "On the awesome and terrible island of Westminster," she told him. It sounded as if she were quoting from somewhere, but he did not believe he had ever heard that phrase before. They began to walk together over the long grass, wet and white with melting frost. Their footprints left a dark green trail in the grass behind them, showing where they had come from. "Look," said Dor, "with the angel gone, there's a lot of sorting out to do in London below, and there's only me to do it. My father wanted to unite London below. I suppose I ought to try to finish what he started." They were walking north, away from the Thames, hand in hand. White seagulls wheeled and called in the sky above them. "Richard, you heard what Islington said to us about keeping my sister alive, just in case. I may not be the only one of my family left, and you've saved my life more than once." She paused, and then, all in a rush, blurted, "You've been a really good friend to me, Richard, and I've sort of got to quite like having you around. Please don't go." He squeezed her hand in his, gently. "Well," he said, "I've sort of got to quite like having you around, too. But I don't belong in this world. In my London, well, the most dangerous thing you ever have to watch out for is a taxi in a bit of a hurry. I like you, too. I like you an awful lot. But I have to go home." She looked up at him with her odd-coloured eyes, green and blue and flame. "Then we won't ever see each other again," she said. "I suppose we won't." "Thanks for everything you did," she said seriously. Then she threw her arms around him, and she squeezed him tightly enough that the bruises on his ribs hurt, and he hugged her back just as tightly, making all of his bruises complain violently, and he simply didn't care. "Well," he said eventually, "it was very nice knowing you." She was blinking hard. He wondered if she were going to tell him again that she had something in her eye. Instead, she said, "Are you ready?" He nodded. "Have you got the key?" He put down his bag and rummaged in his back pocket with his good hand. He took out the key and handed it to her. She held it out in front of her, as if it were being inserted in an imaginary door. "Okay," she said. "Just walk. Don't look back." He began walking down a small hill, away from the blue waters of the Thames. A grey gull swooped past. At the bottom of the hill, he looked back. She stood at the top of the hill, silhouetted by the rising sun. Her cheeks were glistening. The orange sunlight gleamed on the key. Dor turned it with one decisive motion. The world went dark, and a low roar filled Richard's head like the maddened growling of 1,000 enraged beasts.